Welcome, everybody, to KickServeRadio.com Tennis on Air with Andy Zoden. Today, I am joined by one of the great coaches in American sports history, and that is no exaggeration. This man, as the men's tennis coach at Stanford University, over a 28-year period, he was there 38 years, but over a 28-year period, won 17 national championships coaching men's tennis. He had 50 All-Americans in that period of time. And of course, I am talking about the legend himself, Hall of Famer Coach Dick Gould. Coach, such a treat to catch up with you. And congratulations on your most recent induction into the USPTA Hall of Fame.
Andy, nice to be with you. Always good to chat and appreciate all you're doing for the tennis world. It's absolutely incredible.
I really appreciate that.
First of all, I didn't win any of those championships. I had great players, and great players make good coaches. So let's get that straight from the start. But thank you for your comments on the USPTA Hall of Fame. I was very honored to go in there with my good friend and coaching buddy for 20 years, Frank Brennan, our women's coach at Stanford. And we were both extremely honored. And there's not too many college coaches in there. I think Clarence Mabry and Ted Barton are in there, which is great, as they should be. But the rest are down in the trenches, guys, the clubs. And I was surprised, frankly, if there's a college coach, but very honored.
Well, and of course, humble as always, your career coach started at Stanford in 1966 with the intention of coming in and winning a national championship at Stanford, which had a few people roll in their eyes until you recruit Roscoe Tanner, along comes Sandy Mayer, and by 1973, not only do you win a national championship, but as memory serves, you guys won the team title, you win the singles title, and you guys win the doubles that year. You guys win a clean sweep.
Thank you, John Whittlinger, and also accompanied with his doubles partner, Jimmy Delaney, and Chico Hagee had a great run in that tournament as well. Actually, the next year in that tournament. But Sandy Mayer won the first championship at 73-4. He did a great job, and kind of Rick Fisher, you probably never heard of, a local kid, got the semifinals, which was a tremendous win. It was back in Princeton on the clay, and it was quite a thing. It made a big difference to me and my coaching style, Andy, because I had been there starting with the year 66-67, the school year season 67, and before, my coach had been there 16 years, basically since World War II, and really a great guy. I knew a lot about tennis. It was a different world then, how you coach. You just came out and gave kids balls to go hit. I think most guys work that way. And he had never had his team out of the top 10, but the division of teams was incredible because you had USC and UCLA at the top, and then Trinity of University of Texas had great teams on occasion. Froehling, Buchholz, McKinley, Chuck McKinley were all on the same team as an example.
Sure.
They never played the NCAAs because Wimbledon started the day after. The NCAAs were quite a bit later then, but they had a team certainly at least worthy of challenging USC and UCLA. Then I had all these great ideas that, well, this is easy. I do a little more than just provide balls for practice, and I get these guys coached up, and we're going to win this damn thing. Why not? And my first year, we finished 16th in the country, the first year we've been out of the top 10 since World War II, since they started keeping scores. My next year, we were 33rd in the country. I didn't know how many teams played tennis, for crying out loud. My third year, we're 9-12, but freshmen were eligible by NCAA rule, but not by our conference rules. So I went with my varsity all during the season. Before the NCAA, we were getting better. I took four freshmen. They were led, those four freshmen went to the NCAAs, and it was an individual tournament. We're led by Paul Gerken, who transferred the next year to Trinity, unfortunately, and Mac Claflin and three other guys. And they were good enough to finish eighth as an all freshman team. And from then on, we're getting a little better each year. Roscoe Tanner decided to come at the last minute. He'd applied to Stanford, been admitted, but had signed a conference letter of intent to Tennessee. But when he came, it turned everything around.
So as we move into the 70s, Coach, the standard has now been set. You've shown a record of success, and now you're really starting to bring in some teams that are just absolutely loaded. You have a guy by the name of Matt Mitchell that comes in and wins the NCAAs for you, and you're so strong the following year with John McEnroe coming on board, guys like Peter Rennert coming on. Matt Mitchell goes from winning the NCAAs to playing kind of three or four for you the following year. I mean, that's unheard of.
Well, it was an amazing team. In those days, I did get scholarship help. The first time tennis had any full scholarships. So by my second year, I was getting some scholarship help, and we actually got it up to eight full scholarships. And so we were really good, and that was what our department cut us off at, and but that was certainly good enough to be competitive and remain such, even if you lost a guy to the pros. And so we were really good at in those years, and Matt Mitchell did just a great job for us. His older brother before him was an All-American as well.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, John McEnroe comes in, and that team, my biggest chore, first of all, I gave Mac the fall off because he played a lot of tournaments in the old Bill Reardon circuit in the East Coast during his senior year in high school.
Uh-huh.
In the spring, had done well enough to qualify for the main draw at Wimbledon, but he went to Wimbledon representing the United States Juniors, which was the second week of Wimbledon. In the main draw, he just kept on winning. And all of a sudden, he's in the semifinals in the second week. He couldn't play the juniors after all. And then after that, he just kept on playing. I don't think he took a week off all summer. He had great results throughout the year. I don't think he won another pro tournament, but he was always in the quarters or 16s of all of the ones, including the U.S. Open, I believe. And I didn't know he was going to actually enroll at Stanford. Was he still going to come or not?
Well, rumor has it you guys had a little something happen that he comes to the airport and says, "Coach, I'm at the airport. Come pick me up." And you say to him, "You say, John, I gave your scholarship away. I thought you were turning pro."
Yeah, Mac, is that you? He says, "Yeah, I'm at the airport. Pick me up," and something like that. The conversation was, "Yeah, John, I thought you'd turn pro. I gave your scholarship away," and that caused a little bit of silence. And then we got a good laugh out of it. But Mac came in and he played so much that I gave him the fall off, and it was probably the best coaching decision that I made. Mac was not a great practice player as far as repetitions go. He had a very distinct style of play, and the fall in those days we used most of our practice and work on our games. And that was not Mac. He got better by playing a lot, and a lot of people do that just by playing a lot. And he had his own distinctive style. But when we got to February, our first competition was the National Team Indoor Championship in Madison, Wisconsin. I had to make a decision on lineups. So I didn't know what to do. I had three guys I felt were my best players. Billy Mays was one of Northern California's top juniors, a year ahead of Matt, I believe. He was always North Cal, number one in his age group, as was Matt the year behind. And they had a rivalry going, not a bad rivalry, but really obviously pretty intense. And then Mac, and then we had another guy on the team named Perry Wright.
Right.
Who was a really good player. He and Matt were a great doubles team, and as were Billy and John. Well, I said, "Okay, guys, I really think what we ought to do is have you guys all play each other, Matt and Billy and John McEnroe, and then whoever comes in last or ends up number three, Perry, I have to give you a chance. Perry, you're going to get a chance at him." Well, usually when that happens, Murphy's Law, we have three guys playing around Robin, it's going to be 1-1, 1-1, 1-1. Well, fortunately, there was a clear winner. Mac won both his matches, both of them in three sets over Billy and in Matt. And then Billy beat Matt in another three-set match. So that put Matt at four. He had to play his best friend, then Perry Wright, for the fourth, third position, and didn't give his best effort. He was kind of down on himself by then and probably down on me as well. And he had started the year playing number four. Then at number five, we had a really good player in college tennis, John Rast.
Right.
And then fighting for number six, we had three freshmen. Jim Hodges was a great junior. Lloyd Bourne, top 100 in the world to be. Peter Rennert, I think, got as high as number 38 in the world. We're all fighting for the number six spot. So we had a heck of a team in those days, and it worked okay. I thought my biggest fear was the team was going to self-destruct because we had such strong personalities. But they made it through together. They were close friends, but really competitive. And they made it through together. And the end of the year, I think, let's see, I forget what the rankings were, but Perry Wright, my number four guy, finished number 12 in the country. And the other three guys were all ahead of him in the national ITA rankings.
So, Coach, let me ask you this question. Obviously, it's ridiculous to think that, you know, you're having to make these lineup decisions and you've got a guy that's just gotten to the semis of Wimbledon in the main draw and you're not sure who's going to be your number one player. And then you've also got the guy that won the NCAAs the year before and he ends up landing at the four spot. I'm sure there are lots of coaches around the country that wish they had such problems. But when we look at the way college tennis was viewed in those days as a gateway to pro tennis, it seems like that has been conceptually something that has ebbed and flowed from a philosophical standpoint of, well, if you're going to play pro tennis, there's no reason to waste your time with college tennis. You've heard that at different points in time. And at other points in time, clearly you've heard, well, it's a great place to go mature and develop socially and all of the things that make you, you know, sort of more of an adult. Because you know, once you go out on that tour, there's a lot of things that happen both on and off the court that require tremendous maturity to deal with the ups and downs of pro tennis. What have been your thoughts on that as we've watched time go on and see that philosophy change over time?
Well, times do change. When I was in college and through the days of Stan Smith and Charlie Pastorell and Arthur Ashe, you stayed in college. That was an exemption from the military draft as long as you're in college. So it was a little bit of incentive there, and there really wasn't any pro tennis as we know it now. Pro tennis started in the open year of open tennis in 1968.
Right.
It took a while for prize money to build up, for TV coverage to come in, and on a grand scale. So it really wasn't quite the same world. It started to be pretty big. Roscoe was my first guy to leave by turning pro. He'd work hard. His goal when he came in was to build the program up to win a national championship. We finished a very close second at Trinity University, and his junior year, and I'll never forget when his dad called me in to meet with him for dinner at a little restaurant in Athens, Georgia called Ireland's when the tournament was over. Roscoe had lost in five sets to Dickie Stockton in the semifinals. He and Sandy Mayer had won the doubles. And they said they'd been talking to agents. Agents were a big thing in those days, trying to sign the next great American hope. And they'd been camping out with Roscoe, and he said, we just can't afford to come back. We're going to have to turn pro. And I was crestfallen because I thought, hey, we finally are poised now to come back next year and win the thing. And Roscoe, you're the guy that started it all. This is why you came here to do this. You want to be a part of this. He was the only guy I ever tried to talk out of turning pro.
Wow.
And I figured, well, six more months, you know, your points you won during the year, Garen, during the year lasted a whole 12 months, so you're not going to lose any ground there.
Sure.
Come back, get straight into Wimbledon, and so on. But then as time evolved and got to be more money out there, you know, you want guys who want to be in college. I think it was still a gateway to the pros, and guys were still coming to college. I know we would have guys turn pro, but not until after a couple of years of college. I had a couple of guys ranked in the top 100, two or three, Danny Goldie, I believe, Justin Arango, maybe, mm-hmm. I can't remember. But I have Peter Rennert. Peter Rennert was in the quarters of Australian Open and
sure.
Top 100 in the world. They were in the top 100 in the world and still came back to finish one more year of school, because their ranking points lasted for a year. You could go out in those days. There wasn't a best of 18 where you could throw away, or 16, whatever it is now, where you could throw away your best results. You couldn't do that. So it was easier for a young guy to break into the rankings. And you could do that over a course of a four-month summer and a couple of tournaments during the school year. So it was not unusual for a guy to reach top 100 in the world and stay in school for six more months, seven more months, and graduate. We're on the quarter system as well. So a guy could get ahead in school, as Roscoe did, and Sandy Mayer did, and they did come back to school their senior year on time, but they took the winter quarter off to play as a pro, and therefore lost their amateur status. They played all summer as a pro as well, but you could do that, so it was a little easier then with the quarter system to do that. But I think the big thing is that, you know, you have to be realistic about it, and the great thing about our sport is you can play as an amateur in pro events. And by doing that, you can get a pro ranking, so you know right where you are. And it's not hard. You know, now I think about 125 guys are probably breaking even on the tour. It used to be you couldn't break even until you're in the top 50.
Wow.
So it's a little easier to go out there and meet your expenses now, but it's a lonely world going out there, starting out chasing the points. And the tournament's all over the world where you have the best chance to get into the tournament and score a few points. It's not easy, because what you used to be able to do in 4 months or so to get in the top 100, because that best of 18 rule, or again, whatever it is, the top guys, it protects the top guys. They get a few bad losses. It doesn't hurt them in a few tournaments. So now it takes you a year and a half or 2 years to join your buddy who didn't go to college and went out there and now is 198, and he's 98 in the world, or 150 in the world. It takes you, if you're equal ability, about a year and a half or 2 years to get to that point yourself.
Got it. My guest today on KickServeRadio.com, Tennis on Air with Andy Zoden, legendary Hall of Fame, former Stanford men's tennis coach Dick Gould. And coach, at this time, I want to take the opportunity to thank my dear friend and your former number one player, Jeff Salzenstein, for connecting us for the opportunity to talk to you like this today. And his generation of players was a huge, I don't want to say resurgence because it's not like you guys ever dropped off, but he and Paul Goldstein and the Bryans sort of represented that era of tennis where you started to have more undefeated teams. I think you had three lifetimes starting with that McEnroe team. And then as you move forward, Jeff Salzenstein, Paul Goldstein, Bob and Mike Bryan, Ryan Walters, and that group of guys in the 90s also were able to come out and set a standard that was incredibly high.
Well, it's not easy to go undefeated. I know McEnroe's team, Matt mentioned that team that we were talking about. McEnroe's lost, he's playing Elliot Telcher, he's playing Brian T. Guys, I mean, those teams were good on the other schools as well. That team was lucky to go undefeated. We were playing at UCLA, scoring us 5-4. You played 9 points, doubles were played last. You had 1 point for each doubles match, 2 out of 3 sets. And we're playing at UCLA, and UCLA is up 3-2 in the singles before we go in the doubles on John McEnroe's down match point against Elliot Telcher.
Oh.
And a long rally, Elliot serve. He comes to the net at 5-3 in a third set, no ad scoring. Deuce comes to net, works his way to net, and Mac runs across court. It's a backhand passing shot that's out of this earth under pressure, the best shot under pressure I've ever seen.
Wow.
To break serve, hold serve the next game, and then Elliot just kind of melted away, and we saved the season by winning 2 of the 3 doubles. We never could have won 3 doubles against that UCLA team. It was too good. So then we move on a while, and we were undefeated then, and then finally Jeff Salzenstein's year, we had an undefeated season, and it was capped just after Jeff left with a team of my 4 best players were Paul Goldstein, Ryan Walters, a local fellow, really a good player, had won the All-American tournament a year earlier or even that year, I can't recall, and the Bryan brothers. And then at number 5 and 6, I had Alex Kim and Jeff Abrams. Jeff was a national champion in the 1400s. I think he ranked 1 in the country, 12s or 14s. Continued to be a great college player. And, of course, Alex Kim won the NCAAs a couple of years later and was in the top 100 in the world. So that was an outstanding team. And it's really who you're playing. The men's programs got cut back from 8 scholarships to 4.5. The equivalent of 4.5 by NCAA rule, and that really affected the depth in college tennis. So there weren't that many great teams. I mean, really great teams. In fairness, though, that team of Goldstein and Walters, the Bryans and Abrams and Kim, they went undefeated that year. Not only did they go undefeated, I think they lost 3 singles points all year long.
Wow.
And 2 of those were reversed when they met the same player again later in the year. In addition, we lost 1 doubles point. That was an amazing performance, but keep in mind we were playing teams with 4.5 scholarships rather than 8. So I'm not saying it was easier to do. What they did was incredible. But when you look at teams, it's hard to compare in any sport because eras are different, as you know.
Paul Goldstein, I'm told, I had lunch with Mike Bryan several years back, and he claimed that Paul Goldstein was one of the best locker room guys, for lack of a better description, that you could ever kind of go into the trenches with. Did you see at the time that Paul was playing for you that he might eventually become the Stanford men's coach and follow in your shoes down the road a ways?
Well, you know, I had 2 guys that John Whittlinger did it.
Right.
He won these plays in singles and doubles and team. First time anyone had done it. And then Alex O'Brien followed after that. I think USC's Johnson did a little, Stevie Johnson did it, but it's not often. Bob Bryan did it. He won the singles, won the doubles with his brother, but in the singles beat Paul in the finals.
Wow.
And he won the team. But that's a pretty rare, the Triple Crown for any individual is pretty rare. And I think Paul, you know, everyone on that team really was a leader. We sat down. I didn't know how I was going to work my lineup in 44 years of coaching, counting 38 at Stanford and 2 of high school and 4 at JC. I did it differently every year. And this year, I sat the guys down on the court, just on the court itself. I said, how are we going to work this out? And we got guys, so I have a ton of confidence in you guys. I think Jeff and Alex are a little behind you 4 guys right now. We're all there. And I said, how are we going to work this? And they said, Coach, we don't want to play matches against each other. Do what you think's best. So Coach John Whittlinger and I talked, and we went and came back the next day with a plan. I sat him down again. I said, guys, we have 24 matches. What if each one of you played number 1 4 times or played an equal number of times at 1, 2, 3, and 4. And they said, oh, that's good. We can do that. And I said, well, wait a minute, guys. I'm going to tell you right now what match you're going to play, 1, 4, 2, 4, 3, 4, 4, 4, and that's going to be 2 months from now. It goes out 2 months.
Wow.
Can you handle that? Because at that point in time, someone's going to be playing better, maybe at 4, and it should be playing 1. But if you commit to it, we're going to do it all year.
Wow.
And the guy said, that sounds great. And by God, we did it. They stayed true to it. There was no animosity. And Paul was a great guy in leading that. When we sat in that first court the first day, they said, well, Bob Ryan will say, I think Ryan Walters be one. He won the All-American tournament. Then Ryan would say, well, what about Mike Bryan? He's playing better than anyone right now. Mike would say, what about Paul Goldstein? What a great career he's had here. And then Paul would say, what about Bob Bryan? He just won Kalamazoo. I mean, and Paul, they'd say, Paul, you won it 3 times. I mean, you know, everyone was pushing the other guy. It was amazing. So that's what we did. And number 5, I alternated Jeff and Alex all year. And not depending on who we're going to play, I alternated. On that day, I gave them who was going to play what number when, all the way 2.5 months out every match. So they knew at that point. And we stuck with it. They stayed with it, largely because of Paul's leadership. And Paul following John, Stanford's had two great coaches, and Paul's continuing the curve. And it's a little bit different world right now for a lot of the coaches, because the kids are doing so much online schooling. Sometimes they don't get the advice from a high school counselor they would have if they're in a school to encourage them to take things like AP courses, that they are important. In fact, even the USGA development program for a while, and Boca was saying, yeah, we have a good online program called Good College Prep Program, but Stanford wants to see, and I think the Ivies do too, some AP courses in there. And there's no counselor to advise you. You don't take them. And that's really affected Paul's recruiting, very honestly.
Wow.
And John's as well.
Well, Coach, I could talk to you all day about Stanford tennis and college tennis, and I know you've already given me as much time as you've got. I know you're on a tight schedule today, but I just want to tell you that as a guy that was at the University of Texas late 70s, early 80s, we always, and I felt like I was on a pretty good team with a great coach and a bunch of great guys.
You were on great teams. Dave Snyder had what a great guy and
yep.
Tremendous coach, and I know you guys loved him, and I really still do. I really had a lot of respect for how much love you guys had for him, and he was totally invested in you guys, and you guys had great teams down there. Gosh, my gosh, they were playing in the drum with Mac and Kevin Kern,
yes,
and Harry Block, and wow, what times.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that we always admired what you were doing and always held Stanford in the highest regard, and what you've done will never be matched. You're kind of the John Wooden of men's college tennis in this country.
Well, you never say never, Andy. I mean, it's a changing world. Things change. And I'm really happy for my guys, what they achieved. I'm very proud of them, and they've continued to do well. And so many of them are still in tennis and representing our sport well. And I think that's the thing we all have to remember as coaches and as players. You know, we're not playing just for ourselves. We're playing for our team. That message, I think, came across loud and clear in our teams. But we also are playing for our sport. And I think how well we represent not only our team and our school and our family, but how well we represent the sport is really, really important. And I think that I'm really proud of my guys. I think they really felt a good responsibility to the sport. So many of them are still in tennis, giving back in the game in one way or another. Gosh, look, Nick Salviano, all he did is head of player education for the USGA. Then you look at Patrick McEnroe did and the things he instituted while he was head of player development, and Martin Blackman to follow. I mean, what those guys have given to tennis and the broadcasters out there, David Wheaton, Jeff Tarango, all of them, and what they've given back in so many other ways. And you can't find two better representatives in tennis on the tour still, well, three, than Roger Federer and the Bryan brothers. I mean, our sport's blessed to have them. We have a responsibility to try to emulate them as much as we can.
No question about it. And Coach, you are one of the great ambassadors in the history of our sport. Thank you so much for taking the time today. I want to thank Jeff Salzenstein again for the hookup.
Well, I want to thank Jeff too. I mean, what a great, he comes in as a scrawny little guy, hadn't really developed yet. But I knew he was at our Junior Davis Cup training camp, but I could just see him. I mean, he is so well taught by his dad and parents. The guy really had a great game. Miles Cortez and his dad, real dad, both of them, just did a great job with Jeff and his family. I mean, he had his head on straight. He knew what he was doing. He kept things in perspective. What a joy to work with him and watch him develop as he gained his maturity and gained his strength and size. And I did feel he was a sleeping giant, and he turned out to be just that. And I'm so proud of the work he's doing in tennis now, how much he's giving back to the game.
He is becoming quite an educator in his own right, and I know he gives you a lot of that credit. Coach, thank you so much. I appreciate the time. I know you got to get on to your next meeting, but what a treat for me and all of us in the sport of tennis owe you a huge debt of gratitude for all you've done. So thank you so much.
Well, it works both ways, Andy. Keep up the great work, and talk to you soon.
Will do, sir. Thank you so much.